Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast. Tonight on Primetime Politics, ramping up military spending.
The next generation of Canadians and the Canadian Armed Forces members can count on a modern, reliable tools to keep our country safe.
The Trudeau Liberals unveil a multi-billion dollar plan to renew Canadian forces, but still fall short of NATO's 2% target. Why is it so hard to meet Canada's military commitment? We'll speak with the Minister for National Defence. Also, veteran MP Charlie Angus says he will not run in the next election, prompting Pierre Poilievre to accuse him of being afraid to face an angry electorate. We'll hear what Charlie Angus has to say about that. And a recent poll says Liberals are closing the gap on Conservatives. We'll tell you why Tories do not need to be too concerned about the finding, at least not yet. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. The Trudeau government is promising billions of dollars in new defense spending in the coming years, money that will be earmarked for equipment and recruitment as climate change creates a security challenge in Canada's north and as authoritarian regimes challenge the international rules-based order. In total, the government is promising to invest $8.1 billion over the next 5 years and $73 billion over the next 20.
Today, we live in an increasingly complex and challenging time. So now, more than ever, the world needs more Canada and the world needs more Canadians. And whereas in the entirety of the 20th century, we sent our people out to the front lines across the world, we are now on the front lines of new and evolving threats. Technological advances and cyber attacks mean there are myriad ways for engagement that go beyond traditional borders. Rising and disruptive powers like China and Russia mean NATO's northern and western flank is the Canadian Arctic. And climate change is rapidly reshaping Canada and reshaping our north.
But for all that money, Canada will still fall short of the 2% GDP target agreed upon by all NATO countries. And to talk about this, we're now joined by Canada's Minister for National Defence, Bill Blair. Minister Blair, thank you for joining us.
Of course, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So listen, let's start with this 2% really threshold. Canada will still not meet this NATO target with today's plan. How will you sell that to Canada's allies when this country is already being criticized and really urged by allies to invest more?
Yeah, and to be very clear, I've already had conversations with the Secretary General at NATO, with our closest NATO allies, and I've been able to explain to them Canada's significant upward trajectory of defense spending, like basically since 2014, and what this amounts to. By 2029, nearly a tripling of Canada's defense spending. I think I've been able to reassure our allies that Canada's defense spending and the really important focus of our investments in members of the Canadian Armed Forces, but also significant new investments in newer capabilities, is going to enable Canada, first of all, to fill our own obligations to our country, to defend it, and particularly to defend our sovereignty and security in the Arctic, but also create new capabilities that we are going to bring to our alliances in NORAD, in NATO, and in the Indo-Pacific. I think there's a general acknowledgement among our colleagues that we are making real progress, substantive and you know, well-established progress in our movement towards the 2% threshold. But, and there's two parts of the 2% threshold. It's 2% as a target for defense spending, but it also requires that each member spend up to at least 20% of their defense budget on new capital acquisitions of planes, boats, tanks, artillery, and munitions. We are making those investments, and we're meeting that threshold and going to meet that threshold under this new plan for each of the next 20 years. But I think as well within this document, Michael, we talk about some of the foundational work that this enables us to do in order to determine what we are going to require in missile defense, for example, or in underwater surveillance, a new submarine fleet. And as the Prime Minister made very clear in his remarks this morning, we know that we're going to have to replace our submarine fleet. We're not ready yet. We've got work to do to determine what our requirements are and to go to the market and see what's our best option before we start spending Canadian taxpayers' dollars. But we're going to have to acquire that new fleet. And when we do that, and some other acquisitions that we're working, doing the important and necessary work to do to determine that, that'll easily take us into the 2% threshold. And that pathway is really what I've been able to assure our allies. Canada is well established and on that pathway. The other limitation I will also share with you, among a number of our allies, they can simply put out a document saying they aspire to meet 2%. We actually have to book the money through our budgetary processes. That's a requirement of our government and our finance department. And frankly, this is a very, very significant new investment of Canadian tax dollars in defense spending, unprecedented, quite frankly, in our country. And as I said, since 2014, when we inherited what had the previous government had done, where defense spending actually fell below 1%, this actually results in a nearly tripling of defense spending in Canada. That's not insignificant, and I think it is encouraging news for our allies.
Okay, I take what you're saying here, a near tripling of the actual dollar amount, but why is it so hard to get to the 2% of GDP? You know, you appreciate this. We've been hearing it time and again from our allies for quite some time now. Why is it so hard to get to that 2%?
Well, first of all, it's a significant expenditure of tax dollars. We're very mindful of the current fiscal situation in Canada. You know, we've heard Canadians who are concerned about issues around affordability, about housing supply, about a number of different concerns in investments that we have to make. We are making very big investments in housing, in health care, in dental care, in care for seniors, helping raise children out of poverty. Those are things that are very important to Canadians as well. But we also are very mindful of our responsibility, first of all, to fulfill every national government's responsibility to defend its own country and its own borders. We also know we've got a tremendous amount of work that we can do and need to do in our high Arctic. And at the same time, Canada has always been among the leading countries to step up when peacekeeping efforts or investments or in NATO and in the Indo-Pacific and around the world, Canada has always been among the countries that always says yes. And so we want to make sure that we can continue to have the capability to be there for our allies, but most importantly, to be there for Canadians. Okay. And so investments in our far north, this is a real inflection point, a pivot in Canadian defense policy that I think for perhaps the first time recognizes our primary responsibility to defend our country.
Can we talk a bit more about the investment in terms of dollar figures, though? Because in a lot of ways, they're back-ended. You know, $8.1 billion over the next 5 years, $73 billion over the next two decades. Looks good on paper, but it's a promise, because really there's no guarantee that your government will be reelected. So, you know, how much of this is optics and a PR exercise?
Well, listen, we saw under a previous government that they were quite willing to cut commitments to defense spending. We've been putting it back since 2015 when we became the government. As I said, we've increased defense spending by nearly 70%, and with this new policy that we brought forward, a near tripling of our defense expenditure. But at the same time, one of the things that we needed to do is provide, we have partners, not just our allies, but also Canadian industry. We needed to provide Canadian industry with the clarity and the certainty going forward on where Canada was going and what we would require and are prepared to invest in with respect to the acquisition of military capability. Through this policy, we're putting about $300 million into munitions production in Canada to enable Canadian industry to open new supply chains, to establish new production lines, to increase their capacity in order to meet our future needs. But the $8 billion that we've now also committed to the acquisition of those munitions enables us to enter into long-term contracts with Canadian industry so that they know that if they increase production, there's going to be a market for the product they produce, and that we're able to make long-term commitments through these investments. I will also tell you from experience, defense procurement takes time. But if you delay in those actions and if you don't have the money, you can't move forward. And we now have a commitment of the resources we need. And we have committed to streamlining and expediting our procurement processes. That's a whole government effort, but it's a partnership with industry to make sure that we are able to acquire what the Canadian Armed Forces needs. And it's an opportunity to invest in Canadian workers, Canadian industry, our Canadian economy. And so I think there's a win-win that can be achieved here, and we're committed to working with our partners in order to get that job done.
Mm-hmm. Listen, Minister, my time's running out here, but I do want to ask one more question of you. Sure. Because, you know, with this increased investment, really what you're doing is also increasing your focus on continental security with the investments in the north, acknowledging the fact that Russia and China are continuing to challenge Canadian security on the north as the polar ice caps melt. You know, I'm wondering if this focus now will force a re-evaluation of Canadian forces deployments. Already there's a recruitment crisis. Canadian forces are called upon to respond to natural disasters. Will future deployments, peacekeeping or otherwise, have to take a back seat if you're now focusing on continental defense?
Well, it's not my intention to limit Canada's ability to continue to contribute internationally. But at the same time, there's a strong recognition in our new policy document about our responsibilities at home, which means we have to address and solve our recruitment challenges. We need those people, those skill sets, the talent and the commitment that comes with those people to get the job done. We're also investing in supports for them, but also the equipment that they need to do that important job. I think there is no greater responsibility for any national government than the defense of its own country. And, you know, when we talk about Arctic sovereignty, that's not a plane flying over periodically or even a ship sailing by when the ice is out. It means you have to be persistently present. You have to have the capability to defend your country against any adversary. We are seeing far more aggressive action from potential adversaries, Russia and China. We're seeing with climate change, that entire region of the world is becoming far more accessible. We have to be present there. We're going to invest in the Arctic. We're going to invest in Arctic communities. We're going to invest in Canadian Armed Forces capabilities in the Arctic. We have that responsibility not just to our country, but to our North American partner, the United States, to NATO, for Northern Arctic security right across the entire Arctic. Canada has a responsibility, and we're going to step up.
Mr. Bill Blair, appreciate the time this evening. Thank you for that.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Charlie Angus will not be leaving Parliament anytime soon, but the veteran NDP MP says this will be his last term in office, choosing to step aside after 20 years and choosing to not run again when Parliament is dissolved, presumably sometime next year. Mr. Angus is one of the more prominent voices in Parliament, and he has served as the NDP caucus chair in the past and ran for his party's leadership in 2017, placing second behind Jagmeet Singh. Well, we are now joined by the NDP MP for the Ontario riding of Timmins-James Bay, Charlie Angus. Charlie, thank you for joining us again.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show one more time.
Well, you're not done yet. We may reach out.
I hope it's not the last time.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. But listen, you know, agree or disagree with your positions. Without a doubt, you are passionate about what you do. How difficult was this decision to decide not to run again?
I've loved and honored the work of being a voice for people who felt they've been written off the political map of this nation. I've been 20 years at this. There's been some great moments. But when I look at the size of my region, the size of the new riding I'm supposed to take on, I began to think maybe there's other ways I can do what I really want to do in life, being a voice of stirring the pot when it's needed, and also having a bit of a life.
A bit of a life. And, you know, to those who don't know, your riding is being redistributed, reconstituted for the next vote. Had the riding not been redistributed, though, would you have stayed?
Well, my riding already is bigger than the United Kingdom. So putting in perspective, I've had to travel by prop plane into communities, by helicopter, by freighter canoe. I've had a whole whack of near misses on the northern highways, which anyone who drives 11 or 17 knows it's white knuckle ride at the best of times. But I love those regions and I love those communities. And in the new region, I take on 20,000 square kilometers of more territory and more communities that I've never been in before. So it's all about having to build those relationships from the grassroots up. So it's the question is, this is what I've been given. This is what the Electoral Boundary Commission thinks is fair for Northern Ontario. I think it's a ridiculous size, these northern ridings, but I had to make a choice, and I'm very comfortable with the choice I've made.
The Conservative leader, though, he says you are jumping ship rather than, quote, face voters' anger for voting to hike the carbon tax, to ban hunting rifles, as he puts it, for Northern Ontarians. What do you say to that? How do you respond to what we heard from Pierre Poilievre?
Well, I've known Pierre for 20 years, and I've never seen 1 ounce of class in the man. The fact that he's running to be prime minister now, I find that concerning that he makes these. It's not the cheap shots against me. I don't care what he says, but he just lies. I have hunting rifles. My neighbors have hunting rifles. Nobody's taken their hunting rifles. Pierre Poilievre thinks people are stupid, and he thinks he can put out these attacks. So if he wants to attack me, whatever. Again, life is too short to worry about that. It's kind of like being stoned to death with spitballs, and they just think you're going to stand there long enough, you'll fall over. So I'm not worried about Pierre Poilievre's comments about me.
Okay, not worried about Pierre Poilievre, but what about the state of your party right now? Because you are not alone in announcing that you will not run again for New Democrats. We also saw Daniel Blakey leave to join the government of Wapkinew. Does this say anything about the state of the party right now?
Certainly losing Daniel Blakey to WAB really hurt. Daniel, to me, is really a future of our party, but I get it. Wapkinew is doing extraordinary things, and Daniel gets to work closer to home. For the rest of us, it's very much, I think, part of the renewal and transition of politics. Carol Hughes, my colleague, both of us have been really hammered by the riding distribution issues and looked at it in the same way. Richard Canning, Randall Garrison have put in, you know, they have a right to sort of retirement. And in all my years in Parliament, I've seen fantastic MPs step down, leave, and I would think, oh my God, the party's not going to survive. It's renewal. This is what we do. I think we've got a great record to run on. We've done some extraordinary things in this Parliament, and I'm very sure that in the next election, the candidate that we will be choosing for Timmins-James Bay will, the new riding, what it's not even called Timmins-James Bay anymore, will win because it's these are strong NDP ridings.
Okay, you use the word renewal, and beyond the personnel, do you actually think the party needs to also reconsider how it moves forward? Of course, right now, very much tied to the confidence, supply and confidence agreement with the governing Liberals.
When I ran in 2019 and 2021, I knocked on countless doors and people looked at me and said, why should I vote? They said, I can't get my kids' teeth fixed. I can't pay for dentures. The senior citizen said that. And we said, vote for us and we will make dental care a reality. We got ridiculed when we came into the House by the Liberals and the Conservatives and the Bloc, and we brought it in. Dental care will become a reality. We put in place the steps for pharmacare to become a reality. I think the work we did last week on the peace with Gaza was a historic moment, and people noticed around the world. That's what we do as New Democrats. So I think it's a hell of a record to go back to the people with. It'll be someone else other than me, though, because after 20 years, I've just driven those roads too many times. I don't want anyone to think I don't believe in the great work we've done and be willing to sell it, but I also do need to go back to my family. I've been a part-time dad, a part-time husband, part-time community member in my town of Cobalt, and there's a lot of things I really want to do and I need to do.
Yeah, and I think people forget how much sacrifice is involved when one chooses a political life. But you also do talk about a return to grassroots activism, and you say that, you know, there will be more SH disturbing from you in the future. So what is next for Charlie Angus?
Well, my band Grievous Angels are playing again, which is fantastic. That's makes my soul feel alive. So we've got a new record coming out. It's great. But the other issue is I think the climate crisis. And I think it's going to take grassroots activism. We're in a climate catastrophe, and we have a House of Commons full of, I think, climate deniers. They just aren't dealing with this. And I've sat at committees after committee, and I think that a lot of what's going to bring about change in the next battle on the climate crisis will be from the grassroots. So I want to participate in that. I want to continue working in the First Nation communities, which where I started. And, you know, I want to help out at the local museum. And there's a million little projects I got on Charlie Angus's wish list. So stay tuned.
Okay, we will stay tuned. We'll bug you before you're done. But for tonight, Charlie Angus, thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Parliament's two-week Easter break is over, and there are two polls that have welcomed MPs back to Ottawa. Now, one is from Nanos Research that says the Conservative lead over the governing Liberals is shrinking, down to 37% to the governing party's 26%. The other poll is from Léger, which has some disappointing numbers for the NDP. With more, we are now joined by polls analyst Philippe Fournier. He is the founder and the editor-in-chief of 338 Canada. Philippe, good to see you again.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Listen, I do want to start with this Nanos poll. The Conservatives still very much in the lead, according to Nanos, but that lead shrinking by 8 points. How much weight do you put into this finding? Because, you know, Nanos, at this point at least, is a bit of an outlier.
Well, I would be very careful with the term outlier. Yes, Nanos shows a closer race somewhat than other pollsters, but when you just look at the pure math and the statistics of it, we are in the ecosystem where the Conservatives have been polling in the high 30s to low 40s, and so you expect to see the odd 37 or 38%, the same way you expect to see the odd 42 or 43% for the Conservatives, and the Liberal number is basically the same as other pollsters, it's the same as the current average, so this would not really qualify as an outlier for me. Perhaps Nanos just caught an early trend, or we'll know if those numbers are sustained during the month of April.
Okay, let's talk about that, because, you know, Nanos does have this rolling poll number. So could this be the start of a trend?
Well, it's possible. We remember that in last July, in July 23, when we sort of first saw the Conservatives go to 35 and then 36 and then 38 and then 40, it started slow and then it built up. And so, again, we should not put too much stock into one single poll out of all the polling that we have the available. A trend starts with one poll. So I'll be very curious to see if the efforts and the pushback from the Liberals that we have seen in the past month, if it starts to pay dividends. Now, I'm not saying we will see a tie race in the 4 to 6 weeks. That's not what I'm saying. The Conservatives appear to have a very solid lead, especially in Western Canada and now in the Atlantic provinces. A tightening is entirely plausible. So again, we should take a deep breather and wait a bit.
Okay, so a breather, we'll see where it goes. But you know, for Liberals, as you highlight there, they have been very much focused on passing affordability measures. They're trying to essentially jumpstart housing in this country. They're trying to turn their numbers around. You say this might be the start of one, but we haven't really seen that issue move the needle quite yet. Are there things that might actually move the needle now or in the near future?
Well, I think it has been said by many experts, and I'm not an economic expert, but for sure that the part of the affordability problem is, of course, interest rates from the Bank of Canada, which has been a big problem, and inflation. We expect, I believe, sometime this year to see the rates being lowered, and that will help many people pay their mortgage, and it should help cost of living. So it'll be very interesting to see if we see a correlation, because we know that from the numbers of last year, people were really angry, voters in this country were really angry at the Liberals because of cost of living, but if cost of living goes down a little bit and Liberal support does not go up, we will know that it was more than just that. It was also maybe just the wear and tear of time, and also the fact that the Prime Minister is really not popular in the country. In the past year, all the numbers have been negative for Justin Trudeau. It's a very challenging times for the Liberals right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've also seen younger voters move away from the Liberals when you talk about this national trend. But, you know, the environment has been a big issue for younger Canadians. So with Conservatives hitting the carbon levy hard, they want, of course, axe it altogether, and younger voters choosing Conservatives more, does that mean then that the environment is no longer an important issue?
Now, that is very interesting, and I'm not a sociologist. I analyze the polls, but it is true that the environment is always ranking high in polls when we ask what are the main issues facing Canada today, especially on young people. However, historically, in the past few decades, in the past cycles, we have not seen the environment being able to move the needle that much. People, a lot of voters say it is important, but when it's time to cast a ballot, it is not top of mind. And I think that the bet the conservatives are taking is figure out, well, the environment is important for young people, but so is able to afford a home. I think they are aiming for more short-term issues. And so far in the numbers, it's been paying off.
Mm-hmm. You know, before you go, I also want to talk about the NDP, because as I was looking at the Nanos poll, I was also looking recently at the latest Léger poll. And when you look at that, New Democrats in Nanos running at 19%, Léger has them at 17%. If the next election is a change election, how troubled should the party be right now that they're not cashing in on what essentially is a government freefall?
Well, the hope of the NDP, and they will not say that publicly, but the hope of the NDP was that the Conservatives just run away with it and becomes unavoidable that they would win, so left of center voters will be free to cast their votes the way they want, right? If we have a closer race and the fear of a Conservative government drives swing voters towards the Liberals, it could be detrimental to NDP fortunes. Now, of course, with the NDP, we have to look at regional numbers. Half of the current NDP caucus is in BC. And so if you look at the BC numbers right now, the Conservatives have dominant numbers between 40 and 50% province-wide, and the NDP would suffer losses that they could not really recuperate in other parts of the country, at least with the numbers we have right now.
Philippe, it was interesting to go through the numbers with you. We'll do so again in future, but for now, thank you for this.
Thank you, Michael.
And that is our program for this Monday. But before we go, we did want to share with you a look at Parliament Hill as a partial solar eclipse passed over downtown Ottawa earlier today. The total solar eclipse began on the western coast of Mexico before veering off to the U.S., starting in Texas and then reaching parts of Canada just after 2 p.m. Eastern Time. The last time a total eclipse passed over this country was in 1979. The next time one will be visible over North America will be August of 2044. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. Primetime Politics is back tomorrow, but up next, L'Essentiel avec Omaira Issa.